I believe in my powers.
I believe in my powers.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I believe in the power of my teammates.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
Somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way.
Look, okay, just get any blunt objects together, all right? Get cornered, bash him in the head. That seems to work out.
Now, what are we, a team? No. We're a chemical mixture that makes chaos.
Gentlemen, I'm Agent Carter. I supervise all operations for this division.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
And
angels of love!
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
You can't take the sky from Denton Hounding with Megan O'Keefe.
Of course. You said there's going to be a Firefly reference in your tagline.
I promised.
You promised. And I was waiting for it, and then I knew you were going to do the Can't Take the Sky from Me, but I just wasn't prepared, Paul.
And you should know me better by now.
I know, I really should. It's beautiful. So the big question is Denton then, is he Mal?
Obviously.
Okay. All right. That's good. Then who is Kaylee?
Kaylee is not appearing in this episode.
That is very unfortunate.
Kaylee could be Tibbs. I mean,
could be
a gender flip Tibbs, maybe. But I was thinking Tibbs.
That would
more
actually
Zoe.
Make sense.
I was thinking Tibbs is more Zoe.
Yeah,
I could see Tibbs is Zoe. Yeah.
It's sort of Zoe Kaylee. It's Zogle.
Zogle.
Zoli.
Yeah. Perhaps we should tell the listeners what we're talking about.
So that's a scary monster you've created.
I've derailed the podcast in record time, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, we didn't introduce ourselves, so I'm Sean, obviously.
I'm Paul, obviously.
And we have a very special guest today. It's Megan O'Keefe. Hello, Megan.
Hello.
So we're here to talk about your debut novel, if I'm correct, and you haven't secretly written other novels.
I have not. At least none I'll admit to.
None that you'll admit to. Well, every writer has like their drawer full of books that they don't have the heart to throw away, but know that someday when they are 90, someone will find and want to publish, and they'll feel deeply embarrassed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Hopefully that'll happen after I'm dead.
I wasn't going to be super morbid about it. I was going to like leave you alive for that because I didn't want to be kind of creepy.
I appreciate the consideration, but yeah.
So your debut novel is called Steal the Sky. It's from Anger Robot Books. It's getting a lot of interesting love, which is awesome. And, well, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about this book? What is it about, Megan?
So this book is something I wrote in as an experiment to sort of break my normal habits. It's a second world fantasy, which means totally made up planet. And it's about two con men who are attempting to pull off the heist of an airship. And when I sat down to write it, I pretty much only had the first scene in mind. That's the only thing I had. I didn't really know where I was going right off the bat. And I'm normally an obsessive outliner. So what ended up happening with this book is the primary protagonist, Denton Hounding's voice, is a very strong one, and it kind of took over my head. And I ended up writing that first draft in about 3 weeks. And it was a weird experiment for me, because normally I do spend a lot of time sort of doing the back behind the scenes world building and that sort of thing, but this kind of came whole cloth. But of course, when I sat down to revise it, it came, went up from 70,000 words to, I think, 117 at the end. So.
Oh, and that I suspect is because you also added other POVs.
Yeah, I fleshed out Ripka, who is the watch captain that's sort of somewhat pitted against Denton in the book. I fleshed out her chapters a little bit and went in and smoothed out the world building and that kind of thing.
So one of the things that folks may notice about this book is it has a really, really kick-ass cover.
Yes.
I must admit that ever since Brad Bollier, his covers came out with the flying ships on it, anytime I see a cover with a flying sailing ship on it, I'm immediately drawn to it because they're so alluring. I don't know what it is about flying sailing ships that just You can't not look. And yours happens to have one in it, and it's lovely.
It does, yeah. When Mike came to me, Mike Underwood, who's the marketing director over at Angry Robot, he came to me with a very rough sketch of what he wanted the cover to look like. I mean, it was just like stick drawings, you know. And I promised never to speak of that, but I've spoken of it many times, so that worked out well. But he came to me with this stick drawing. He was like, this is the direction I think we should go in. And I was just so excited because I could see that big ship up in the sky and knew it was going to be good.
Did he actually draw the ship?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, we have to give him crap for that.
I want to see this art. I want to write a novel just so Angry Robot will publish it, so I will get a stick figure drawing from Mike. This is adorable.
It was a thing of beauty.
You could, based on that it tells you a lot about who Mike is. He is a bit of a dork, and it's lovely.
He's a great guy.
Oh, he is, and he clearly loves what he does, to draw stick figure drawings of your cover. Well, that's really awesome, yes. And it is a really excellent work of art. I think it's very well done.
Yeah, so. It was a Kim Sokol who did the art, and I think, I'm not 100%, but I'm like 90% sure it was her first time doing cover art for like a fairly larger novel release, which I thought was pretty cool.
Well, she did a fine job.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want let's start here with the main conflict of your novel, which is this heist. You mention it in your description of the book, and we have the opening chapter is, I think, really fun because you have Detton who's been captured by Ripka because he's not allowed in the city. He's not supposed to be there. And there's stuff we won't reveal about this scene, but basically he's being asked, or well, he weasels his way into getting a heist job in order to undermine a city authority or one an up and coming potential city authority. So very clearly, the beginning of your book is dealing with just the fun part of the heist idea, but at the same time, the sort of political ramifications of this city. And I was hoping you'd talk a little bit about sort of establishing the politics of this world, and then kind of fleshing that out as you went along, some other things we may want to bring up later, but kind of starting there.
Mm-hmm. So that first scene I wrote, the first scene of the book is pretty much wholly unchanged, just a few word tweaks from the time I sat down to draft it. And it was pretty loaded when I went back and read it, when I was continuing to do that really quick burst rough draft in the beginning. And I realized I had set up a situation where I had what was essentially a continent that was very sparsely populated, did have an indigenous population, and this empire that has rolled in and for the sake of collecting a natural resource that is only available on this continent, set up basically colonial outpost cities and pretty much taken over the whole dang place. So I had to think a lot about what kind of tension that would breed. Colonialism is obviously a very contentious thing for many, many kinds of reasons. And the type of people who, and also I had to think about the type of people who would exploit that situation. And that's where I got the idea for Thradia, who is our up-and-comer political figure who owns the nice, shiny airship. And her very cuddly nickname is General Throat Slitter because of nasty things she did while she was still working for the Empire. But she is essentially exiled for the Empire that's taken over the continent. And doesn't like that, so she's trying to use her money and her status, essentially, as this respected military figure to sort of rise to power in this colonial Wild West sort of situation. It's very complicated, which is a lot to extrapolate from that one scene, but that's where
it does. It does very much set up most of the political conflicts to come, and we get to see those sort of developed and threaded. And of course, characters we didn't realize were involved suddenly are involved in ways we hadn't anticipated, which I really appreciated, sort of the ways in which character backstories suddenly became important to the politics of the world, especially Deaton's, which we may come to a little bit later. But Paul, you had a hand, so you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
I did. I wanted to, Megan, to unpack the politics of a world a little more. I you do seem to have, you have two levels of politics. You have the internal city politics that Thrati is trying to rise to power, and Ripka doesn't want her in control, and other forces within the city are in conflict against her. And I'm trying to avoid spoilers as much as I can there. But then you also have the greater geopolitical concerns of the empire. I was curious as to what historical models were you inspired you to create the politics of the empire and of the city.
Well, really, I stole primarily from two sort of naval empires, the England, of course, under Queen Elizabeth I, and the Dutch Empire is the West Indies trading. The name has fallen out of my brain, but you know what I'm talking about. their sort of conquest specifically of spices and that type of thing. They were after a natural resource, which heavily facilitated their trading. It was one of those, if you had nutmeg, you could store meat forever, and therefore you could take over the world kind of situations. And in this case, the seas surrounding the Valathian Empire, which is sort of our conquering colonial force, are very rough. So to sail out and conquer the world is a huge problem. But if you have psyllium, which is the gas that can only be found on the scorched continent, you can elevate your ships because it's basically like a super helium type situation. And then you can take to the skies and further spread out. So they're very much a merchant empire in that regard. And that's very much stolen from the Dutch.
So psyllium is basically your East Dutch East Indies spices, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. So magic as a natural resource is something that has always interested me.
Are there any models within fantasy that inspired you to exploit magic as a natural resource? I'm thinking of things like, say, Larry Niven's Magic Goes Away, and any novel that uses mana as a depletable resource.
I wouldn't say novels. I actually haven't read the Larry Niven book, so I need to do that, apparently. But a lot of my sort of aesthetic and thematic influences came from the early Final Fantasy games. Final Fantasy VII, particularly, was as soon as Final Fantasy VII was one of the first like big computer game releases I played after things like, you know, Myst and Unreal Tournament and that kind of stuff. But Final Fantasy VII was the first game I played that had a story. And as I was going through it, as soon as I got the airship, I was hooked on airships forever. So it just opens up the world. It's fantastic. And of course, you have the whole, you know, materia system and that kind of thing. So it is very much a resource.
Well, and another aspect of this resource, which is related to these questions, which is that people who are sensitive to psyllium are essentially oppressed by this government. They're controlled. They are part of that resource, in part because, of course, you kind of need them to mine the minerals, right? Because it does float. It presents problems, I suppose, for trying to keep control of it. So it's interesting because, of course, that's obviously a theme that we see prevalent throughout historical empires, is using some sort of a class of individual as your labor force, often via force. And in this case, we learn fairly early on, so I don't think this is a real spoiler, but, you know, Detton has a past, which is related to psyllium. And it presents problems for him because, he's in a position where he's running around basically free, at least as long as Ripka is going to let him. And yet he is also sort of drawn to the psyllium at all these various points. And he can't seem to let it go. Whenever he feels it, he feels drawn to it. It's sort of his curse. But he knows that if he basically reveals his hand, he puts himself in a deeply compromised position because of the world. And, was this something that you saw yourself, that you really wanted to sort of dig into the kind of nitty gritty side of this aspect, or do you see it as more of a kind of a background concern to some of the other elements of the plot?
That was really a central focus for me, is that basically the use of these magic users as sort of indentured servants, essentially. And of course, we know indentured servitude is not something you can ever really get out of. It's the kicker there. And I wanted to, essentially, there's this sort of old fantasy trope where, you know, your special protagonist discovers they have great skill in the magic, and maybe some evil force is coming along to try and use it for their own good or whatever. And right before the bad thing happens and they get taken, or maybe shortly thereafter, you know, the resistance shows up, and suddenly they get taken to this magical school where they're trained how to do wonderful, cool things with their magic, and everything's great. And that doesn't exist in my world. Being a magic user is not a fun thing on the Scorched Continent. It is a duty and a curse, and sometimes a death sentence if your particular flavor of power deviates too far from what is useful to the Empire. So,
one of the things that you brought up, and I'm sorry, Bob, but I'm going to jump over you because I see you have a hand, but you brought up death. And we should mention, you brought up death and the Scorched Lands. One of the ways in which you can die in this place, or possibly not die, is to walk across the Black Sands in whatever you happen to be wearing at that moment. And if you're lucky, you live, presumably severely burned and not feeling very good. If you're not so lucky, you die. The alternative, of course, that's offered is, or we could cut your head off. Which is an interesting... I don't know if I would say moral dilemma, but horrible dilemma that's presented to anyone who happens to be in that position. And I do find it interesting. There's a moment in the book where another character says, well, why don't you just offer them hanging instead? And that way they would choose the Black Sands on purpose, right? They walk across that on purpose. Right. And yet, there's an ulterior motive. We won't explain what that is, but
oh yeah,
I like the idea that no matter what options you give, they're both horrible options. They're they're both torturously bad, and yet apparently so many people choose to walk across the sands.
Yeah, well, I mean, generally as humans, we will sacrifice a lot for just kind of a hint of hope, and. Whether it is a horrible thing to walk across the Black Sands. It's basically a giant stretch of very, very sharp, unweathered obsidian glass. And it is painful and it is hot, and you will probably not make it. Or if you do, you'll be horribly disfigured and messed up. But there's a chance. So I think that's a pretty strong lure for most individuals.
Hope is a powerful motivator.
Yeah.
True. I think I would just cut my head off. Good.
Yeah. A lot of people do choose that route in this world.
it kind of reminds me a little bit of Escape from New York. At the beginning, you're offered, oh yeah, you can be dropped into New York to live, or if you prefer to be terminated on the premises, please talk to your duty officer.
Oh, I haven't seen that, but that's great.
Yeah, in case you don't want to get thrown into New York with the criminals, yeah, you can get killed right then and there.
Huh, I like that.
Well, and there's that the thing you see quite often too, you know, where do you want to be shot? In the head or the heart?
Right.
As if either option is good.
Yeah.
presumably the head's quicker, I guess. Yeah,
if you're lucky.
But then of course the villain's always like, oh, okay, I'll shoot you in the opposite one.
Of course.
Because they're a villain.
Because they're a villain, and even in your last moments, you don't get what you want.
Nope.
So Paul, do you want to jump in with your next question?
I did. I wanted to make it to unpack a little bit more about the magic of her world. And one of the things that struck me was how much people are, how much misconceptions people have about psyllium users and what they can and can't do. And I wanted you could unpack illusionists and people's misconceptions about their power and their abilities and how they react to that and how they use their sometimes odd and unexpected talents.
You mean Doppels, right?
Yes, Doppels.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that was a total bait because there's...
Yes, there's this whole copy between calling them Doppels and calling them illusionists, right. Yes.
One is technically in the world, I think, and Megan, you may correct me, but I think it's intended almost kind of like a racial epithet.
Yeah. It It is. So it was psyllium magic users, basically people who can sort of kinetically manipulate this gas with the thought. They all are based on sort of one principle. It is essentially they can all move the gas. And the gas is made up of a prismatic molecule, so they can shift it certain directions to make it create certain colors. They can move it together very, very slowly to sort of make cold and or very, very quickly to make heat. And they all have varying degrees of this ability. But what the Empire likes is your nice sort of median middle of the road. We can move it, we can shape it, we can use it to sort of, you know, affect steering and airships, and that's about it. They don't want any of these high-end magic users or who can shift the stuff around on such a fine-tuned level that they can actually use it as a mask and disguise their appearance. Now, well, because they're afraid of spies and that kind of thing. So the people who lived there before, the indigenous population, who were called the Qatari, they had sort of come to terms with what they can do with the magic there, and they have their own little classes. They have, you know, names for the different variations within the magic users, and one of those is an illusionist, and that's your very high-end, can manipulate extremely small amounts of the stuff at very precise levels. And they're capable of creating basically visual illusions, your masks and that kind of thing. But they can't, it's not just that they can create masks. They can also create larger illusions. They can make you think a wall is somewhere where it isn't. They can make a plant appear, that kind of thing, as long as you're looking at it from the right angle. And when the Empire rolled in and they discovered that these people were a thing, they wanted their sort of invading population, the people they were sending out to, you know, drill the holes, do the building, the washing of the clothes, your sort of support community for the mining, to be afraid of them because they wanted them gone. They didn't want these, you know, very refined magic users to be able to infiltrate their system in any way. So they, in very, very, this is outside of the book, this is further in the timeline, in the very sort of beginning of the settlement process, they started spreading like bedtime horror story type situations, and they called them Doppels because they have, can change their faces, and they're sort of, you know, a Doppel can come in and replace your parent and you'll never know. It was that changeling fear. So the Imperial descendants have this sort of collective lore that Doppels are inherently evil because of this and inherently want to, you know, do the whole replace your child type situation. And they hate Doppels. In fact, that particular ability is punishable by death on the Scorched Continent because it is so scary to them. And the Empire is just pleased with this because that's exactly what they wanted to happen. And the Qatari people are still fairly insistent that they are illusionists, but illusionists that move amongst the population of the Scorch, that sort of mixed Qatari, Velathian mingling, are able to use illusions in such a way as they're not noticed because of this, because it is so very much a part of the collective lore of the Scorch continent now that Doppels change their faces. People forget they can change other things as well. And so the illusionist in my book uses that to her advantage on multiple occasions.
Yes, and in some cases, a little bit of creepy comedy involving mixing heads and bodies.
It's my favorite kind of comedy.
That part cracked me up.
I'm a bit reminded of the Psychords, Sean. The Psychor from Babylon 5.
Oh, right, okay.
And wanting to have control over anybody with a psychic talent and taking measures to make sure that happened.
Well, it's certainly one of those things. I mean, you see this in all kinds of stories, right? Science fiction and fantasy stories, where someone has some ability and whoever happens to be in power wants to control it. Because once you have an ability that is beyond that power structure, that power structure can't actually control, it becomes a threat. And I think that's part of, I mean, the Doppels, they also represent a very real threat, right? So if you can take on, you know, the body and voice and everything of, you know, your city official, you could send out horrifying orders, or you could undermine the empire, right? It makes power very difficult,
right,
to maintain.
Yeah.
Perhaps we should ask Megan about the White Coats at this point.
Yeah,
what were your inspirations in creating the White Coats and creating two very creepy characters, Callier and her little apprentice. I think she's almost even more creepier than her mistress in some way.
Yeah, I love a creepy little girl character. Those are always my favorites. So the White Coats are basically, as the Empire is sort of doing their thing and saying, oh no, deviations on this magic use are bad, we can't have those, we should execute all the Doppels. They are, of course, collecting people of that nature to study them and figure out if, hey, maybe we can use them in different ways, like you do. And part of that inspiration, I like creepy medical type things, and so I wanted to play with that a little, but it also comes from sort of the MK Ultra stuff that we did here in the States around, oh gosh, I want to say the 60s. Just sort of experimenting with edge theories for possible sakes of, you know, national defense. At least that's what you call it anyway. But looking for, the Empire's always looking for an extra advantage, and the White Coats are trying to find that in their deviant sensitives.
So one of the things I wanted to kind of jump back a bit, which is, we've been talking about the politics of your world, but something I think we should actually ask you about is, what is it for you that you think is unique about fantasy in its broadest sense, or even in a narrow sense, its value for sort of exploring these types of themes? I mean, what makes this genre for you different from, say, if you were writing like a historical narrative or a traditional drama where you were dealing with sort of more realistic subjects? I mean, what do you think is really valuable about this for that kind of ideas?
So the really cool thing about fantasy to me has always been that creating a world and saying everything's new and different, you can basically take any sort of societal issue, piece of history, whatever, that sort of we as humans have experienced on this particular planet, and unpack it without its baggage and insert it into another world to maybe reframe it, give a fresh perspective on it, that sort of thing. It's like when I say the White Coats are sort of like the MK Ultra project, which was a horrible, horrible thing that if you're not aware of, I believe it was the CIA who intentionally dosed many subjects with large amounts of LSD to sort of see what would happen. That's something that we have a lot of baggage about in our culture, because, you know, well, the CIA was trying to protect the nation, but they also did this horrible thing with human experimentation. You get some pretty hard lines drawn in the sand based on personal sort of tribal loyalties. But if you remove that from, you know, that sort of inherent tribalism and give it a whole new framing, file off the serial numbers, make it look like something different, but the core sort of moral conflict is still the same, you can maybe come to sort of new ideas and greater understanding. I think fantasy is an inherently unique vessel for exploring our own social issues in that way.
And how do you see that as versus, say, science fiction? Why fantasy over science fiction, say? Or do you not see a difference?
Don't see much of a difference. I'm actually writing a science fiction novel right now. So.
Something we will have to ask about later.
Yeah, I am on both sides of the genre divide.
So I do have a wonder then, this is going far afield from the book, but since it's related to your answer, which I think is a great answer, and I feel very much the same way. Do you watch by any chance the show Black Mirror?
No, I haven't seen that yet. My quiet geek shame is that I actually don't have a lot of time to watch shows and that kind of thing. So I'm way behind everybody when it comes to that.
That's fair. Netflix is doing a US edition, which I'm hopeful for, because mm-hmm. the BBC edition is well, I'm hopeful because it's Netflix doing it. So
Yeah.
Let's get that straight. If it was like ABC, I'd be like, no, they're going to screw that up. But it's Netflix. I think they could really do some biting critique of US culture. But the BBC version, I think it's BBC, it's exploring these ideas in some cases in kind of futuristic versions of reality that are, I mean, it's some of the best science fiction writing I think we've seen in film, in a while. It's just, I don't even know, just watch the first episode. All I can tell you is that episode led to people accusing the current Prime Minister of England of having done something with a farm animal.
Oh my. All right.
Yeah.
I will make time to watch that.
That's where that comes from. That's right.
It's something else. And it does very much make me think that there's something about Black Mirror that, I mean, some of the episodes are certainly very, very present-y. They're very much like in our moment. But there are other episodes where, like, they've done one where they extrapolated, like, what does the future look like if we keep going down this path of reality TV where basically our entire lives are dictated by reality TV?
Mm-hmm.
Go. It's not a fun future, I'll tell you that.
No, yeah.
But it's utterly fascinating. So it just makes me think the same thing, because I think that you're right. That's something about science fiction and fantasy that we can kind of remove ourselves from our reality a bit. And we can kind of let those juices flow, which is, I think, is a good thing. I think that's useful, that we can extract ourselves from our biases, not entirely, but to some degree, to be able to explore ideas that otherwise would be unsavory.
You can also kind of sneak up on people a little too. Dean's a fun, charismatic guy. He's out there lying his butt off and, you know, doing things that he knows will probably get him in trouble, but they're fun, so he's going to do it anyway. And so you've got him, and he's got such a strong voice, and he's just sort of mulling his way through the world. And then you start to see all these little dark things creeping up on the edges. So it can come on you a little slower that way. And I think maybe have more of an, oh, that's not okay moment than just sort of outright, you know, dumping it on you immediately. Fun to do for me.
Excellent. Excellent. Paul, do you want to jump in here and maybe us back towards the book?
I'm going to steer us back to a more writing technical thing. So you said you started writing the book from Deaton, I call him Denton's perspective, and starting with that first scene. But I've noticed that the book layers on more and more protagonists as we go through. I mean, we don't really get a point of view really from the White Coats till later. So I was curious as to how you went about structuring the book, especially once you had that opening scene. You said you were mostly a plotter, not a plotter, but you had pants. So I was curious as how you managed to bring it all together, because the book does leaven very interesting action beats with much more serious meditations upon the nature of empire and layering and hopping between characters. And the storylines are very distinctly different. Denton's storyline is much lighter in some ways than especially Palkia's, who is a very dark story, and Ripley is kind of caught in the middle. I was curious as to your writing process, as how you managed to braid that all together as well as you have.
So once I had written that first chapter, I wrote the first two Deaton chapters I wrote sort of in one burst. So I skipped that chapter two, which is a Ripka chapter. After I'd done that, I looked at it all and I thought, well, you know, I want to show different angles of this world, and Deaton's perspective is so incredibly unique. It's not really suited for sort of reaching out and touching these other things, because a lot of the things that Ripka and Palkia's storylines touch on, Deaton is sort of actively avoiding, not thinking about, for spoilerish reasons.
Yeah.
because things happen to him. So I wanted to bring those in to sort of illustrate that things aren't all cheerful with this world, and signal to the reader early on that it's not going to be a completely, you know, happy-go-lucky romp type situation. And to really, I just like writing different characters who all have their own motives and their own voices, and maybe they're all The closest to the good guy in the book is Ripka. Even then, sometimes her motivations get a little muddy. So I like having your gray moral character scale available to look at. And when I, as far as writing it all through, that was primarily during revision when I made sure those were all balanced and hitting the right notes or beats I wanted them to hit.
Good, good. We've talked about Deacon a lot. Let's talk about some of the other guys. Let's talk about Pokaya. I mean, without being too spoilery, and she has had a rather tragic past and is doing some rather unusual things to see things through. So I was curious as to, I mean, I could see where you came out with Deacon. I mean, his antecedents, as it were, unconscious or not, are in every freebooting rogue from Mal to Han Solo. So he's got a ship. He goes flying around. He doesn't have a care in the world. He likes to scam people. I mean, he is a Han Solo analog. Han Solo Mal Reynolds analog in many ways. But where does Pokaya come from? What taproots did you tap to bring her and her story to life?
So, Palkia is not something I took any sort of direct inspiration for. And part of that is because she is not a young woman in this world, and that is uncommon enough in our genre.
It is. I was hoping to bring that up.
And she is a mother, and a grieving mother in this case. That's not too much of a spoiler. It comes
not
up
too much
in,
of a spoiler,
in her
yeah.
first point of view chapter. So, and she's trying to retake control of her life, and that's not a perspective, from that sort of midpoint in her life, already a grieving mother trying to reclaim control. We don't normally see that point of view being as active as she is. She is aggressively going after her revenge situation. So I can't say that I took any direct inspiration from anything already existing, because I haven't been able to find anything like it. I think I wanted one of those characters to exist, so I went for it.
I mean, it's almost it's almost like a Shakespearean sort of tragic going for the revenge no matter what the consequences.
Right.
Sort of filter I have is like she's a grieving mother. She's not a young chicken, and she's moved things so now that she's going to take what she thinks she should do, and damn the consequences. It's very, as I said before, very much in contrast to Deaton's story. And Ripka's kind of in the middle. You have this poor, she's caught by duty. She's caught by other things. She's got problems running around the city. She's trying to keep it from falling apart. There's the Empire lurking outside. She's almost like the hard bitten cop that has to do her job day after day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as Ripka goes, I know we've had a lot of talk in genre lately about the grimdark trend / phenomenon. And, the Scorched Continent isn't a nice place. My book isn't grimdark by any stretch of the imagination, but, maybe some stretches, I don't know, but.
some parts are, but.
Yeah, some parts get pretty dark. But, the way I think those sort of settings work, the grimdark settings, that is, particularly well, is when, even when things suck, characters are really trying anyway. That's part of why I think Abercrombie's works perform so well as grimdark is, everything sucks and people are trying and failing, but they're still trying. And that's sort of what Ripka is. She is the embodiment of trying to do the right thing as far as she can tell, despite everything sort of going to the pits, as it were, around her. So
you have something, Sean, or I can continue rambling?
I did think, when we're first introduced to, I'm going to butcher her name.
Pokaya.
Pokaya, thank you. It's actually a really sad sequence, this moment where they're searching her stuff. And I was wondering, like, when you were writing that particular their scene, because it is essentially the first scene we've had from the perspective of someone who's actually been oppressed under this system. And yet you sort of weigh this very careful balance between, you know, what she's saying to us through her thoughts versus how she has to present herself to the people who are basically going through her whole house, searching all her stuff. And it's this really tense and really uncomfortable scene, because it feels, to me, it felt sort of like almost like a violation, but one that can't be spoken. She can't say it. She can't she can't even express it. She has to sort of just smile.
Right.
And I mean, did you find that particularly difficult trying to write in that kind of mode of trying to sort of give that without sort of exploding out with, you know, the feeling that most of us are probably having reading that?
Yeah. I mean, that particular scene is, I wanted to show, because the first time we hear about Pokaya, we don't know her name. We just know that as far as the city is concerned, there is a doppel loose, and she's on a, you know, murderous rampage, and oh my gosh, everybody's afraid of this, you know, monster creature. And then when you actually do see her, at least see her point of view, she's, you know, she's an older woman, she's a grieving mother, she's having to sit back and grit her teeth while the local, you know, watch, which is basically the constabulary type situation, the police, do what is ultimately an unlawful search of her home. And it was difficult to balance. It was difficult sort of to get those emotional notes just right, because she has dealt with a lifetime of this. This is just a repeat of her whole life. She has been stepped on in this way pretty much ever since, you know, it was discovered that she could use psyllium. And she is, at this point in her life, decided enough's enough, and she's fighting back. So she has that other layer of added tension where she knows she's fighting back, but she can't do it just right in this moment, otherwise she'll blow the whole thing. So she's fighting within herself as she's trying to put on this sort of brave face for the people investigating her home.
I think that's interesting. What you described, right, because, you know, the first time we hear about Doppels, I mean, basically anything we hear about Doppels in the first, I don't know, third of the book is basically negative. It's not nice things about Doppels. Even Deaton, right, doesn't really... It's clear he doesn't hate Doppels. He just doesn't like them that much.
Yeah.
They're creepy and weird, and they cause trouble, right?
Yeah.
There's this sort of foreboding sense. The second we learn about a Doppel, the book just makes it very clear that nobody likes these people. And I think it's a really interesting choice to sort of then go into that character and try to unpack the stereotype. Because I think that's what you were doing, is just sort of ripping that apart and saying, like, you don't have to necessarily agree with this person's... you may agree with their motivations, but maybe not with the actions they're choosing. That's right. Not relevant. What it is about is trying to humanize them, trying to make them into people so that we can understand why people do what they do, even when they're things we don't agree with. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you hear all these terrible things, you know, they'll come in and, you know, take over your family members, and oh, she's killed the leader of the city, and oh, they're scary. And in the beginning, you see one put to death for being, you know, just what he is. And then when I finally do switch to Balkaya's point of view, she's an older woman sitting in a chair with a quilt on her lap with sore knees, you know? She's thinking some nasty things while the watch is going through her house, but she's very much a person and very much relatable.
And if you met my grandmother, well, she doesn't think them, she just says them now.
Yeah.
My grandma's, she's just got a smart mouth. I love my grandma, but... Yeah.
That's great.
One thing that this did make me wonder, because I noticed on the bio on your website, it says that you were raised amongst journalists, which I find is a really interesting phrasing. And then, of course, it follows by you apparently did a newsletter involving cats, which is adorable. But I'm curious, how much, if at all, did, you know, having journalistic parents or being among journalists Has that affected how you write or how you approach character in any way?
It's possible. If it is, I suspect it's subconscious at this point. My mom, single mom, she was a journalist for, 22 years, I think it was. And being a single mom, and, you know, journalists don't generally make that much money, I spent a lot of time sort of hanging out in the back conference room at the newspaper she worked at, just messing around with stuff and checking out the papers and stories. And she's also an English major. So we had, you know, the house was always full of books, and we always would go to the library, and I could pick out whatever I wanted. So stories, they've always sort of been around me. It's always been something accessible to me, as far as writing goes anyway. And my mom then moved on from being a journalist to being an English teacher. And to tell you a little bit about what journalists get paid nowadays, she became a teacher because the pay was better. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. Journalism, not the best career choice at the moment.
And people wonder why it's so hard to find good journalism.
Right? Yeah. And she also didn't appreciate the direction the paper she was working for was headed. They got bought out by a major media corp. So,
oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
That was fun. So, I've always sort of had this double-edged sword of stories are awesome and they're all around me and I love literature. And also, you can't make a living selling stories. That was very much apparent to me in my childhood. So I never particularly thought about being an author as a kid. As a young adult, I suppose, I enjoyed it, but it wasn't until... Well, I did, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and that kind of thing, and that sort of storytelling, pretty much my whole life. But it wasn't until about, almost three and a half years ago now, when I found the Writing Excuses podcast, and I went, oh, this is the thing people really actually can do. So,
that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah. Writing Excuses is great.
Okay, so interesting. Okay, so it just seemed to me, I don't know, it was a question that came up to me, thinking about, really good journalists have a way of approaching even difficult and contentious topics by mm-hmm. trying to get at the people that are behind it.
The human element.
Right,
yeah.
The human element. Right. You know, not passing judgment, but just saying these are the people. You don't have to like what they're doing, whatever it is they happen to be doing. But there are people involved, and we need to remember that. And it just seemed like there was some aspect of that. But then again, maybe that's just being human. I don't know. But doesn't bode well for all the people who don't do that, because then maybe they're not human. Maybe X-Files is right.
No.
They're all doppels, or it's like X-Files is right and the alien invasion started a long time ago.
That would explain a lot.
That would explain so much. And then the big question becomes, is Donald Trump an alien?
Oh, yes. Is that a question people are asking?
I don't know. I feel like it's possible he's a person.
Like his hair is definitely an alien. Maybe it's like a brain slug from Futurama. It's controlling him.
Possibly. Or he is like, he is what the smoking man becomes when he becomes rich and actually succeeds at the things he tries. Because if you recall from the X-Files, right, the smoking man wants to be a writer, but he's apparently really terrible at it. And that's supposed to be part of the reason why the smoking man is a cold, hard bastard. Which, by the way, terrible motivation, but whatever.
Failed writer, therefore
becomes guy who murders lots of people in the service of aliens. You know, whatever.
Makes total sense.
That's normal. Yeah. So maybe Donald Trump is like that. It's what happened to the smoking man if he had succeeded, but not at writing, but at being a vicious businessman.
I was going to say, at being a person in general?
Oh, Donald Trump's a person. He's just not a person most people like.
Yeah. No, actually, I think it's a little dangerous to sort of dehumanize people who are
jerks.
That crazy.
Because
you run the... Yeah.
That's fair. That's a very good point. Yeah. Yeah. Donald Trump is a person. He is a human being. I just don't agree with many things.
But he doesn't have a airship.
He does not have an airship.
He does have a Boeing. So what is it, 737?
That's not the same, but, though.
But he can't hold parties on his airship like Thracia can.
That's true, yeah.
Be honest, that's all you need to be president. If you just get an airship and hold parties, everyone will vote for you.
Well, she's doing pretty well with that.
I suspect, like, some of the reason people might be attracted to Trump is because of sort of the spectacle of who he is. Sort of like this is moth to the flame situation. And, you know, part of what Thready is trying to do with the big, ridiculous airship and parties, so.
It's kind of like a cult of personality thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe a cult. Cult may be the wrong word. That gives the impression of a different kind of thing, but.
Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, personal magnetism. Just like showing, like, here I am, look how great I am. I mean, she is general throat cutter, so.
She
has a larger than life personality, and people are attracted to that C-forward Donald J. Trump.
Well, yeah. and an interesting thing is the first time, maybe it's not the first time we meet her, but one of the first moments when we go to that first party, and when they're basically casing the joint, because of course, right? They got to steal the ship, so they got to check it out. And one of the, there's just like a little line in there where you mention, the kinds of people that are at this party aren't just the upper nobles. They're people who are in lower sections of the city. Still in positions of power, but within their lower sections, right? It's clearly like a divisions of class. And it's very clearly suggested, right, that part of the reason why she's doing so well is she's not just appealing to the people who have the wealth or all of the power. She's appealing to people at the different levels of the city, at the different classes, which makes her very much a people's, like a person of the people, in quotation marks, because, yeah.
Oh, yeah, she's a very canny politician. If it wasn't the fact that there's a murderous doppel running around and Deaton wants to steal her ship, she'd win in a walk. She's got these local problems.
A few little issues there, yeah.
Yes, a few. It's normal, right? Day-to-day work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I could see that if it, on a kind of sort of surface level comparison between her and Donald Trump, but not in obviously, we should be really clear. And this is not, obviously not the intent. It's not like you sat there and thought, I really hope people compare my book to Donald Trump.
Yeah. That is not a parallel I ever thought I'd be drawing.
Welcome to the Skippy Fandy Show.
We're weird. We are definitely weird. Okay, we should not talk about that anymore. Let's just move on.
Yeah, Trump gets enough airtime.
Yeah. Well, he is air, so.
Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense.
If you put some psyllium in, he could float.
You'd have to seal him up on all ends first, though.
That's easy enough to do. You just get glue.
Yeah.
And you just put a little sail on him, you could ride that guy around. Would that not be a great political cartoon? I'm just going to delete this part out because this is ridiculous.
that is a horrifying image.
Just people riding floating politician airships as a critique of American politics.
I wish I could draw, but I can't. But let's talk a little bit more about the book before we move towards the, yeah. So one last thing I want to talk about. I mean, we've talked about sometimes how dark this book is, but a lot of this book has very good action beats and sequences. And I was curious as to where you got your chops in writing kick-ass action. Because, I mean, Deaton does lots of swashbuckling sort of stuff. I mean, we get stuff on airships. We get chases through the city. We get him infiltrating the salt baths. We get all sorts of fun action beats. And I was curious as to where you had come up with your inspirations and your chops in writing all that. Because they were immensely entertaining.
Oh, well, that's good. I think I probably honed my, as far as action scenes go, I honed that particular talent way, not too far back. It feels like way back in the 90s. When I was, like I said, I did a lot of role-playing type stuff. Dungeons and Dragons primarily, but a bit of, a bit of like the White Wolf games too. Like, I don't know if you remember Vampire the Masquerade and
I GM Exalted for years, so
excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was a part of a bunch of because where I lived there weren't very many geeky types. We were kinda out towards the California Valley. Not a lot of nerds out there. So I found these online forums, basically, where people would they're bulletin board type situations. And you'd play your character and tell your little storyline, and it was a post-based system. So you were always responding to somebody, and your responses were usually in like the 500 to 750 word range, sometimes longer. And you learn very quickly that if you're not entertaining and you don't hit those action beats, you know, really well and have fun with it, that people don't want to play with you. So,
uh-huh.
Yeah, I think I definitely honed my sort of storyteller fun action vibe thing doing Dungeons and Dragons and White Wolf and that kind of thing. And later I had like an in-person group that I was always the DM and or storyteller for. So that's always fun, yeah, trying to keep.
I've seemed to notice that a lot of writers these days, especially, have had DMing experience in the past. But it seems to be the same sort of brain quality. You can go and be a GM, but you can't do both because they seem to interfere in your brain. They seem to take the same sort of ideas and space. Because I do a lot of GMing myself, and as a result, mm-hmm. I don't write as much as I could, so because it's like I keep thinking about plots and stuff for my role-playing games rather than, you know, actual stories, and it's like it seems like I can have one or the other, not both,
taking too much of that mental bandwidth.
Exactly.
yeah
Well, this leads me to a related question, since we're on the subject of writing. I don't usually ask writing questions, which is odd. But, you know, your website says you finished the draft of, Scorched Continent Book 2. No title, but I'm just going to assume it's going to be a sexy title. So,
very sexy.
Very sexy, of course. But I'm curious, you know, have you found it difficult to sort of maintain a writing schedule? And what are any things that you found worked for you to kind of maintain it?
So, I work for myself, and I work from home, and I work a creative job, and I am one of those kinds of people who would much rather be up until 4:30 in the morning and sleep until 11 than the other way around. So I often will write in the evenings once sort of like all my other creative work is done. And part of what I do, I'm a professional soap maker, just put that out there. So, I ship a lot. I sell online. So when I'm doing my shipping station, it's a lot of really repetitive, you know, wrap this in bubble wrap, put it in the envelope, put the shipping label on, stamp it, send it out. And that repetitive tasks gives me a lot of time to sort of do the whole think through plot situations. It's just like going for a walk, you know, it's this sort of physical white noise. And so by the time nighttime rolls around and all my work is done for the day/evening, I can sit down and basically write until I get too tired to write anymore. And that seems to work well for me. I do occasionally fall asleep while writing, and I'm always amused to wake up and discover my last sentence was like some sort of weird Mad Libs situation. That is like close to being grammatically correct, but makes absolutely no sense. I always wonder what my brain's doing when I do that, but it's fun, so I don't mind. And I also have a writing group that meets every Saturday morning, which is not my favorite time of day, but we meet from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., and that's a good time to sort of catch up with your fellow writers and hash out ideas, just sort of talk about writing type stuff and get some writing work done if I need to.
And it offers a potential deadline you could use.
Yes. Yeah, there's that structure there. When your beta readers are glaring at you because you haven't given them a thing to read, it gets scary.
Yeah, you start feeling that guilt deep down.
Yeah.
You go home and just cry by yourself.
Yeah. Put on some sad music.
All my music's sad.
Aww.
I don't listen to a lot of what I think people would call happy music. I'm a weirdo.
Yeah, I listen to a lot of metal, so...
Metal can be happy.
It can be.
It just doesn't sound like it to people who aren't metalheads.
Yeah. If you listen to Psycho Stick, they're this parody metal band. So they've got like really hardcore, like rawr metal songs about like taking a shower or... eating tacos. They're fantastic.
Tacos are so metal.
They are. They're super metal.
Psycho Stick.
Psycho Stick. Yeah, you need to look them up.
That is the greatest band name ever. That's wonderful. Okay, so that, in any case, I think, yeah, you've had a pretty big advantage in the sense that you've worked the job where it requires you to be self-organizing to a degree, which, by the way, you are the first person that's ever been on the show who makes soap for a living.
I'm shocked.
I'm sure someone who's been on the show has made soap at some point. Yeah,
but as a business, yeah.
As a business, you are the first.
It's kind of an odd transition, because I did art history and archaeology in school, and I worked for a local city's sort of arts program as a curator. And then I moved on and I worked for a very small nonfiction publisher who does like medical textbooks as a head of graphic design there. So, which basically means I drew a lot of naked people for diagnostic charts.
Wow.
It's wonderful.
That was one of those situations where I really enjoyed the work I was doing. Think of that what you will. But the sort of interpersonal situation there was quite toxic. So I was like, I need to move on from this. And I wasn't really sure. This was, gosh, right after sort of the big, 2008. So not a lot of jobs on the market, especially in the Bay Area at the time. There's a mini sort of Silicon Valley collapse at that time. And anyway, so I was making soap. I was doing it as a hobby. I was pretty good at it. And I had done a lot of freelance work before, all throughout actually school. I did freelance graphic design online in a time before PayPal existed, actually. I was doing work and you got paid through the system called Pay by Gold, which I don't think is even a thing anymore, but it worked. So I had some experience doing, work for myself and that sort of thing. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try. I had a friend who was in the soap business in New Zealand and she was doing pretty well. So I applied my graphic skills and my business savvy and gosh, 7 years later, I'm still doing it. I went, yeah.
Well,
The soap making, it was a bit of a risk, but we ended up replacing my income in the first year. So
what?
It worked out well. Yeah.
Wait, but you live, okay, you got to help me understand this. Because, when people think like, oh, they make soap, right? Like, they don't think of soap as being like high-end, unless you're buying like some really crazy expensive soap that's made like from like Himalayan yak milk and like it's right. Shipped from the moon. Right, like if you're paying for like some real crazy stuff, which is maybe what you make, but let me,
yeah.
So you live in so people understand this. You make enough money on selling soap that you can afford to live in the Bay Area, not
yes.
Like the Bay Area of like Minnesota. No, not like the Bay Area, like I don't know, some place that's not expensive. The Bay Area of California, one of the most expensive places to live in the entire world. And you sell soap.
Yep.
How much soap do you sell?
A lot. So, I literally like shipping containers full.
Whoa.
Occasionally. My soap isn't particularly expensive. It's $6 a bar on average. And I do candles and perfume and lip balms as well. And it's really sort of grown exponentially over the years. I've been very lucky. Actually told Mike when, again, Mike Underwood, the marketing guy over at Angry Robot, when they told me I had a January release date, I laughed. I'm like, okay, you guys understand, through November and December, I work like 16-hour days. Like, that is my busy season. I make a third-ish of my yearly income during those 2 months from, the Black Friday to December 20th. It is an intense experience. I was like, you guys want me to plan a book release during this?
Whoa.
It worked out. So, yeah.
I'm just like, I mean, I know, like, it shouldn't seem surprising, right? Because obviously, like, nobody would make soap if nobody can make a living, right?
Right.
Because that's just obvious. Somebody's mm-hmm. making a living. It's just amazing to me that you've, wow.
there are actually, as far as I know, there are three of us in the Bay Area who do soap making full time.
Wow.
Yeah, and we're all very different styles. We don't overlap markets at all, so.
But for some people, Sean Dial will not do. They want the Amaretto tiramisu soap or the coconut lime soap or the... Yes, I'm on your website, Megan.
Yeah, somebody's been browsing.
Someone is browsing while we're talking here because they want to see what kind of soap.
I may have to buy some soap.
Yeah.
I want to smell pretty.
She has quite the variety, Sean. So.
I'm really impressed because it's...
And that's blushy.com, listeners. BLUSHIE.com.
Yep, that's awesome.
I ship all over the world. It's pretty cool. Like I send things to like Saudi Arabia and South Africa and Finland, and it's fun.
So cool.
It's also maybe I shouldn't say this, but it's a good sort of mining source for names. I get so many interesting names from all over the world. I'm like, ooh, I'm going to use that someday.
That is so cool. So okay, just the last thing about soap, because, well, we've been talking about it for a while. Clearly you like what you do.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, what is it for you about making soap that you just really enjoy? Like, what does it for you with soap?
So I'm a really big fan of both art and science, which are difficult things to overlap in some respects, which is why I was interested in archaeology and that kind of thing. So with soap making, I make all of my soap from scratch. And to do that, there's a lot of math involved. There's a lot of experimentation involved. So if you've seen my soap, you know, they're very colorful. They have, you know, specific colorways and designs and that sort of thing. So I get to combine both sort of artistic endeavors with this sort of experimental mad scientist side, which I enjoy. And that comes through, especially when I'm building fragrances, because aroma chemicals, which are bits of essential oils, synthetics, and all that kind of thing, are there are thousands of them, and you have to learn how to use each one appropriately and what works best with skin, because all of my perfume oils are applied directly to the skin, and human skin likes to eat fragrance. So yeah, you have to learn how to sort of work with that. And scent is so deeply tied to human memory too. You have to kind of figure out, okay, well, when people think of the scent of a banana, right? Most people don't think of like what a Cavendish, which is your common Chiquita banana type. They don't think of what that smells like, which is basically nothing. They think of like the Runtz banana candy. So you have to reinterpret, you know, what a banana means to your average sort of consumer, I guess you'd say.
That is so cool. So it's like an enormously creative process.
Oh, extremely. Yeah.
That
right
is
now,
cool.
I'm working on an old book smell, which has been fun and complicated, because that is an incredibly personal smell. And there's a lot of sort of misinformation floating around the internet by way of, you know, old books smell like vanilla because of the way the lignin decomposes. And that's not quite right. A lot of the way old books actually smell is caused by fungus, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was mold, yeah.
Yeah,
mold and the binding glue and the ink are the more predominant smells with an old book. So, but people, when they think of an old book smell, because most people have seen this, or people who would be interested in an old book smell anyway have seen this, think vanilla. So it's like, okay, well, there has to be a vanilla note in there, otherwise you'll sort of let people's expectations down, whether that is reality or not.
That's interesting. But your soaps have nothing to do with human fat, right?
No. I don't know where the Fight Club meets, and I won't tell you.
I'm sorry, I had to make the Fight Club reference. I had to, sorry.
No, that's horrible. We were having a great discussion, Paul, and you made it creepy.
I had to make a Fight Club reference. It was obligatory. We're going to talk about soap, Sean.
Well, it is, of course, a reference that's in her bio as well.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, actually,
when I was at Writers of the Future, Kevin J. Anderson introduced me. And when he made that Fight Club joke, like, he had the biggest grin on his face. It was great.
That's wonderful. Okay, so really, really quick. Last thing about soap, and then we got to literally stop this because...
We're talking about it all night. Yes.
This is now a soap podcast.
I'm utterly fascinated. I got to admit that I never thought that I would think about soap and go, oh, that's a really interesting creative process. It's so exciting. And
here I am going, wait, this is
it's about like tricking human minds and it's about creation and science. And it's like if you took Bill Nye and you put him in a box full of cats and that's what we would get. We just get this crazy man. And then it's, but in soap, it, yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry, but if you ever make a brand new magic card smell, I will lather myself in that constantly.
Ooh, that's a good one. Okay, I'll put that on the list.
That's so good. I'm the weird guy that when I open cards, if I forget to smell it, I feel guilty. It's so weird.
You want to know what that primarily is? I can tell you.
Is it ink?
It's ozone, actually, specifically. Laser printers, the CMYK process with laser printers tends to produce a lot of ozone. That's why you get that very distinctive smell when you're hanging around like a big laser copy machine. And it's the same process used to print the magic cards, and they get packaged so quickly that a little bit of actual ozone gas, which is a tiny bit poisonous, gets stuck in there. And it smells really good, I think.
I think it smells delicious. What?
Yeah.
What? How do you know this? Where did, like,
she has to research this stuff in order to do soaps with all the scents.
She's got to research. Like, clearly, like, she didn't just make it up. She went somewhere and found this information out. Like, how did you find that out?
Well, the thing about the fragrance industry is that it is incredibly secretive with its information. There's the big houses, like you get, you know, your Chanel number 5 and that kind of thing. Those recipes are like hidden behind massive vaults, and they have proprietary chemicals and all this kind of thing. But there is a fair amount of perfumery science textbooks that exist in the world, and they're fairly limited, but they are out there. So, yeah. 8 years of research.
Have you seen the movie Perfume, The Story of a Murderer?
You know, I have not. I need to, because I get asked that often.
It has the late Alan Rickman in it, among other.
Yeah.
Among other actors. Yeah, it's a really strange movie. I liked it. It's maybe not quite my thing, but it was well done. So, yeah, I would think this would be right up your alley.
I'd have to check it out.
This is amazing. This is the first time on this show we have talked this much about something that has nothing to do with the book. And certainly,
no, that's not true, Sean. Well, okay, that soap is an
that's true. They do go
topic.
To the baths, and there's
and when I read that, it's like, okay, she's taking her knowledge of soap. And
that's fair.
And I kept imagining, kept seeing the baths in terms of the baths down in Arkansas, the hot spring. That was my I don't know if you intended that or not, but since I had recently been to the hot springs this last year, that's why I kept seeing the Buckshaw baths when they were wandering around the salt baths, even though the geography and layout isn't quite the right.
Also, that it's covered in salt everywhere.
I could see, must be hot springs. No, there's salt everywhere. But you've been to the hot spring baths. This is what it is. No, my brain's
weird. Well, keep in mind, they also apparently ship in the salt.
They do. They brought those up from the flats. Yeah.
Which, good gosh, that's a lot of work.
Yep.
But certainly the nobles didn't do it.
No. Yeah. The people paying for it didn't do it.
Certainly so. Okay. Anyway, I'm sorry.
If you pay very close attention to the book, I stuck a little perfume thing in there, in which the person the Doppel is imitating and the Doppel herself wear two different perfumes.
Because there is a point in the book where Deaton says jokingly, right, your legs are shorter, but I don't recall a perfume thing, and now I gotta go find it.
Yeah, it's kind of an Easter egg. It's a little sneaky in there. So
this is wonderful. I am so glad. Like, we've had some great conversations where we've had authors on and we've just talked about like random stuff. So when we had Fran Wild on, we talked, like, the first time we had her on, we spent 20-25 minutes just talking about cities and how to deal with sewage.
Yes.
That's great.
And she's like, she gets a little embarrassed about that, but I found that utterly fascinating, because it's not a question anybody asks. Like, where does all, where's it all go?
an important question.
It's kind of important. You can't run a city without some form of sewage drainage. Or, well, I guess you can, but it'd be a terrible place to live.
It's an awful city, yeah.
Yeah. And here we are talking about soap and me learning stuff about soap that I never thought I would ever have learned and actually have made soap fascinating to me. I just thought it was something I put on my body that makes me smell sexy. But apparently it is also a scientific crazy land, and it's wonderful. So that's wonderful.
Thank
so
you for
thank
sharing
you.
That, yeah.
Of course.
We mentioned before, right, Scorched Continent Book 2 is in draft form at this point.
Yes.
Which makes sense, because they're probably not going to publish it tomorrow.
Probably not. I'd be very surprised, I'll put it that way.
I think we would be too. How they got that done so quick, it would certainly suggest something about the publishing industry that needs to change if they could get a book turned around that fast.
Yeah.
But so the big question is this. Do you have any idea when the next book's going to come out?
So book two, we think, we don't have a firm day, but we're looking at October as the release date of this year for that one.
Sweet. Okay.
Yeah, so pretty soon.
What about any other writing you have any working on? You mentioned earlier in this episode, for example, that you were working on a science fiction novel. Is there anything else we might expect from you? Short stories, that kind of thing?
So I've got a few short stories I've been working on. I've been sort of focusing on novel type things this last year. So I told myself in 2016 I was going to get back into doing short stories more often. So I got a couple of those I'm working on. One of my favorites has to do with this little random piece of Italian folklore, which is there were a group of people in about the 15th century in Italy called the Umbrellae. And what they did was create really magnificent umbrellas, tarps, and that kind of thing, which doesn't seem too cool until you realize this is the 15th century, and they were dyeing these, and they were able to make them so that the dye wouldn't run, which was huge at that time period. During that time, mostly, if you created an umbrella, it got wet, and if you had dyed it, the dye would run all over you and ruin your clothes. So there's this little enclave of people in northern Italy making these things, and they were very, very secretive about their process because they were selling to kings and queens all over Europe. You know, they had a lucrative deal going. And I got the idea to write a story about them, and this is the spec fic element, because they were so secretive, they sort of created their own little language and having to do with their terminology for this craft. And the community in the area eventually started creating this tale about a little demon gremlin type thing called Il Tarusk, who would come to you and tell you this secret umbrella language, and then you could go join them and be a craftsman. And they tend to, sort of in the tradition of Italian craftsmen and craftswomen, they tend to take your orphans on board to sort of work with them. So that was, you know, this little gremlin thing going around and telling orphan boys specifically to go join them. And you know this language now, you can make amazing umbrellas and you'll be rich and everything will be great. So I'm working on a short story wherein that little guy is real. And that's been a lot of fun because I love Italian folklore. And after that, I'm working on book three for the Scorched Continent too. I'm fleshing out that outline a little bit more. As soon as I signed the contract with Angry Robot and I knew they were buying three books, I sat down and wrote the last chapter of book three. So I sort of always know where I was going. So working on that.
Well, okay, so that's great. So we should expect hopefully the new book, if not October, then certainly the end of this year at some point.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So and the third book should probably be sometime either early or mid the following year. So
wow, you're rocking them out. Good job.
Yeah.
So any convention appearances this year, Megan?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just did Confusion in Detroit. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed it.
Yeah, it was really great. I highly recommend it if you want to come out next year. It's kind of like a little mini world fantasy in sort of feel and that sort of thing. More industry focused, it seemed to be. And cool. I am doing Worldcon and probably Phoenix Comic Con, actually in June. And then there's a local con here called Fog Con that I'll be doing. And I've also been told I may be a guest at BayCon, which is another local con. So
cool.
Yeah. And then the science fiction book is something I'm I'm just about to start drafting, so we'll see. If Sam can sell it this year, I might have a... Sam's my agent for this
one. At Jabberwocky, correct?
Yeah.
Jabberwocky.
Yeah, so if he can sell it this year, then we might see it sometime soonish.
Cool. Well, this has been awesome, and
we've learned a lot.
Things I didn't think I was going to learn, and I'm so excited. I love learning new things and finding out things I didn't know anything about and thought were kind of dull were actually super exciting and interesting.
Yeah, that's one of the cool things about sort of science fiction and fantasy authors I've noticed as I go to more and more cons is they all have like random hobbies or just interests. Like I know I met Brian McClellan and he's like, oh, I keep bees.
Yes, we talked about that too.
Yeah, we did.
I was really excited about that too. It's like bees, like why are you keeping bees? And he just thought, it all right, let's do it. Like,
so cool. Yeah,
I keep reptiles and I search for them, although I'm mostly just a podcaster, but still.
That's right. Yeah, you're reptiles. I always like seeing their updates.
Yeah, I have a bunch of pictures I gotta share, but I haven't done it in a while.
And I travel and do photography, as everyone knows.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. What I really want is to get Paul and I to go hunting reptiles together, because he could take the pictures and I could catch them.
Yeah.
He can find them, I can photograph.
Yeah. And Paul would get some sexy pictures. we could do like a calendar, Paul. We could do like a monthly calendar of lizards in bikinis.
I'd buy that.
There we go. We have always week one sale.
Have you seen the cover to the, I can't remember the author's name, it just left me, but Lust Locked, the mellow from Tor? It's got like the sexy lizard poking out, it's got his little tongue.
Yeah, Matt Wallace, yeah.
Yeah, Matt Wallace, that's it.
Have you seen it, Sean?
I am literally looking right now. Oh, yeah.
It is such a you cover, Sean.
Right? Yeah.
It's an iguana. It's an iguana. It is a me cover, yeah. I'm sorry, I got really excited for a minute, and I just started going back and forth in my chair, because...
Easy shot.
I'm such a dork. Well, any case, so thanks so much, Megan, for coming on, talking to us about your book, talking to us about soap.
It was really
a treasure. It was wonderful. Thank you.
It's a lot of fun.
And folks, if you want to find Megan, she's easy enough to find. She has this website thing that you can go to if you would like to go to it.
Yep. I can say it too.
You could say it, and then I'll say it, and it'll be subliminal. It'll go in. Yeah.
Yes. It's MeganO'Keefe.com.
Yep. It's MeganO'Keefe.com. In case you missed it.
Yep.
I'm just gonna delete that out. That's just silly. I shouldn't repeat. Okay. I shouldn't repeat your website for you. Yep, you can find all of her stuff on there, her books, her short stories she's got.
The link to her soap site.
Yep, link to her soap site. She's got a blog. She's got links to all her social media. She's got a Pinterest account. So if that's your thing and you're like, yeah, I like Pinterest, she's got one. You can follow her there.
Pin boards for my books, which is kind of fun.
Cool. See? So you're all set, guys. So anyway, thanks again, Megan, for coming on and talking to us about your book and everything.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been really, it really has been a lot of fun.
Yay. We've succeeded, Paul.
We have succeeded.
And once obviously, again, Paul, thanks so much for just being always part of this. I love you, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. And on that note, folks, awkward ending and scene. Our intro and outro music comes from Nocturnia by Psychedelic Pedestrian. You can find out more about them on freemusicarchive.org, including the full version of the song. We obviously made some edits to the song, including sound effects and, of course, shortening the length. You can also support us by going to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to send us a suggestion, you can do so at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. You can also go to our website, skiffyandfanty.com, and check out the little suggested topic form at the top there. You can also just send us emails. You can also find us on Twitter at skiffyandfanty or on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Just search for us on there. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next time.